You're tuned to WEOS Geneva or WXXE Fenner, Syracuse. This is Unwelcome Guests. Coming up in our second hour, a look at the role of religion in politics.
His father was a World War II pilot. He served in the Guard as a pilot.
You could say winging it is a tradition in the Bush family. Yep, winging it. And with God as my co-pilot, hey, what's this little button here do?
George W. Bush. He's coming in on a wing.
Oh, Lord.
And a prayer.
In a film, Contact, based on the novel by the late astronomer Carl Sagan, a young scientist discovers a radio signal from an advanced extraterrestrial civilization, which invites an emissary from Earth to a meeting. The ETs send the plans for a spacecraft that will bring the Earthling emissary to the meeting. But who will be chosen to go? Not the young scientist who made the discovery, after facing years of ridicule from her peers for her research. Instead, an older and prominent scientist who has been chief among her critics is chosen. Why? Because the young scientist has made no secret throughout her life that she does not believe in God. And she is grilled in congressional hearings on this and disqualified. While a spirit of ecumenicalism reigns in America today that tolerates religious diversity, woe be to the person who openly states that they do not believe in God. Don't ask, don't tell. Every major party presidential candidate since I've been eligible to vote has made a big show of their religiosity. Both Bush and Gore have flaunted it, while each has been responsible for a trail of dead bodies in their wake. Each directly worked to take food out of the mouths of desperate people while supporting the wealthy in their lust for profits. It has been a widely held view that religious belief is a prerequisite to ethical conduct, to conscience. A friend of mine faced this problem when he filed as a conscientious objector during the Vietnam War. In order to legitimately refuse to kill people under orders from the U.S. government, belief in a supreme being was requirement number one. He challenged that, and was the first to have the U.S. government officially acknowledge that conscience and religion were not synonymous. Religious people have indeed used their faith as a basis for the pursuit of social equity. The abolitionist movement, the civil rights movement, and the peace movements have all had a large religious component. However, both in the past and present, religion has been used by government to justify greed, murder, colonialism, racism, sexism, and a host of tyrannies. Next, Dr. Michael Parenti will speak on the political uses of religion, how religion has been used throughout history to oppose the forces of democracy. This talk was recorded in 1987 at an American atheist convention, so he pulls no punches. If you can't bear to hear someone criticize the Bible, please tune out.
A few years ago, I went on a yoga retreat in the Caribbean, a little island. It's an ashram where people practice yoga. I went because I like yoga. Unfortunately, the head of this yoga sect was there, the head Swami, a very religious man, and he gave sermons every morning, which the guests were required to attend. And every day he talked about love and the higher cosmic force of love. And every day he talked about how spiritual things were everything and material things are nothing. And he was an Indian. He used to say, spiritual things are everything, material things are nothing. And then one day, his yacht got loosed from the pier and it began to float away. And he started to scream and said, get my yacht, get my yacht. And he had a yacht and he had a seaplane. And this man of love, I noticed, was filled with hate. He yelled at people. This man of God was full of ego. He got up and talked about how no one is perfect, only I am perfect. He kicked out a couple of people from the place because they raised some questions, and he threatened to bring the police in. And it occurred to me that this Swami was the perfect theocrat, that what we had here was a theocracy. using the power of the state to enforce your will, and countenancing no alternative opinions, and up to your ears in wealth. In a theocracy, there's no democracy. Now, religionists say that they're anti-materialist. They're against materialism. But that word materialism is a very funny one. It's subject to a number of misinterpretations. In fact, there are two real, quite different uses for the word. There's philosophical materialism, which argues, as you know, that ideas do not exist as independent forces, independent of material reality, as disembodied mystical forces. As the great materialist Karl Marx said, men sometimes get ideas in their head and they're so vivid that they then impute to these ideas an external existence of their own as some force out there. Now, the religionists, to be sure, are anti-materialist in that sense. That is, they believe in these spirits and they believe in these externalized imaginings. But there's a second use of the word materialism. And when we use it, we often use it, I think, instinctively, quite correctly. We associate it with consumerism, self-interest, power, possessiveness, what I would call acquisitive materialism. And now here, most religious organizations really are very dedicated to this kind of materialism. They acquire throughout the centuries, they have acquired, and in many different cultures, in many different countries, in many different eras, the one thing all these religions have had in common, almost all of them, is that they have acquired vast properties and wealth, and they have used political power. They've used the legitimated authority of the state, the legal use of organized force and violence, which is Max Weber's definition of the state. They've used political power to advance their own material interests, to win gain for themselves, to exploit people, and in fact to maybe often win advantages over competing religious sects, because there are often fights between each other for who's going to grab the goodies. And for centuries they've been involved in secular intrigues, in conflicts, in wars, in ways that have often violated their own religious precepts. Let me give you just one example from the thousands of examples from history that I could give you. Martin Luther. Now, we all know the Martin Luther who started the Reformation with his anti-materialist rebellion against Rome. But there's another lesser-known Luther, the other materialist kind of Luther, the apologist for the German princes, the defender of the aristocratic class rule. The Martin Luther who, in 1525, when the peasants were starving, when their land had been taken, when they couldn't even get a decent amount of firewood to heat themselves, when their children were going hungry, when the rents were crushing them, and they were desperate, and they rose up in rebellion in 1525, and they took over the cathedrals, and they took over the castles, and they formed committees, and they reorganized the use of the wealth, and they reorganized the use of the land for themselves, and they rose up with dignity. That Martin Luther got up, and this is what he said. He said, "This is a blasphemy." He cursed the rebellion for turning, quote, everything upside down like the worst disaster. By the way, his own prince, Frederick the Wise, says this. Let me quote him first. He said, "In many ways, the poor folk have been wronged by the rulers." Take something when a prince admits that. "And now God is visiting his wrath upon us." But not Luther. Luther knew which side God was on, and God is on the side of the aristocracy. And he said, I don't quote him, "Is everything upside down like the worst disaster?" And Martin Luther repeatedly urged, quote, "Everyone who can to, quote, smite, slay, and stab the peasants, secretly or openly, remembering that nothing can be more poisonous, hurtful, or devilish than a rebel. It is just as when one must kill a mad dog." And of course, he quoted numerous passages from the Bible to justify his call to butchery. And the German princes didn't need too much encouragement. They slaughtered 100,000 peasants. And historians agree that that's pretty much the estimate that could stand. So this Luther, the great spokesman for the one true God of love and the Prince of Peace, was up to his neck in homicidal bloodletting in a repressive class war on the side of those who have more than they know what to do with against those who want a fair shake. Now, sometimes it works the other way. Sometimes the religionists use the state to advance their interests. That's what we mean by the religious uses of politics. And sometimes the state uses religion to legitimate its own exploits, and that's the political uses of religion. So politicians use religion, and religionists use politicians. This is not to say that nothing's changed. Indeed, there have been remarkable historical developments over the centuries. There have been remarkable victories for our forces. There's been a rollback of theocratic power. I mean, compared today to the 10th century, let's say. The diminishment of religious wars in the West and the secularization of social life with the advent of science and with such forces as industrialization, urbanization, and modern socialism. But these advances don't come, and history doesn't work in a neat historical succession. Just when we think it's going one way, much to our dismay, it starts going another way. But generally, the move has been in a positive direction. But remarkable residues of the past are still with us. When you think about it, it was just 30 years ago that there existed an age-old theocracy. I mean, a theocracy that was about 2,000 years old. The society was still organized that way in Tibet. And when the People's Republic of China reclaimed its citizenry over Tibet and sent its troops in and its organizers and its social welfare people, all these people came in, the U.S. media were filled with stories about these beautiful monks who had to be carried to India, who were now deprived of their religion. They weren't deprived of their religion. You could practice Buddhism in China if you want. What they were deprived of was their enormous wealth. The thing that the media didn't tell us about was that in Tibet, those monks ruled that country. Those peasants lined up and gave their food, their livestock, their everything else. They exploited that peasantry. Those monasteries were rich. It was a feudal theocracy that lived off the backs of these peasants. And those monks had a good thing going for them. And that class was blown away. What the media doesn't also tell you now is that the average peasant in China, for whatever else you want to think about or say about the People's Republic of China, the average peasant in Tibet today goes to school. He gets enough to eat. His kids get enough to eat. He's got a co-op, a communal farm, whatever it is to work on. He's got some place to go to. He gets medical attention when he needs it. And those things did not exist when God ruled in Tibet. We also could note how theocracy, I mean this thing about this erratic quality of religion sometimes, when one of the most murderous and repressive theocracies emerges today, in the last 8 or 9 years, in Iran. The right-wing faction of the Shiite movement won a victory in Iran. You know, when they blew up all those mullahs and those guys who came for a mass meeting, that was the sort of the mujahideen, the reformist group. They were all slaughtered in one blow. The mullahs who rule in Iran and live off the people and live very well and are carrying out this endless, murderous war against Iraq with the assistance of our cowboy in the White House there. And also right here in America, as the previous speaker pointed out, there has been a real resurgence of this religious right. For generations, religionists have served corporate capitalism. They've preached obedience to the status quo. They've opposed workers trying to organize and form unions. They've opposed syndicalism, socialism. It was portrayed as the work of the devil. And in turn, capitalists, the big rich robber barons and the owners, were inclined to present themselves as the recipients of the deity's highly selective blessings. Let me quote one of them. John D. Rockefeller Sr., quote, "I believe the power to make money is a gift of God. Having been endowed with the gift I possess, I believe it is my duty to make money, and still more money, and more money, and more money, and more money, and to use the money I make for the good of my fellow man according to the dictates of my conscience." So from this we may conclude that God is a financier. And so too today, social and political leaders constantly call upon God. Every president of the United States feels compelled to do this, but no president more so than Ronald Reagan. And it's a little scary. You know, it's one thing for certain right-wing evangelicals to announce that the Bible prophesies an imminent apocalypse, that we are now in the third and final stage, the third and final millennium. That the Antichrist forces from the East, as portrayed by Gorbachev in Russia, will meet destruction, Israel will convert, and Christ will return triumphant to deliver death upon the non-believers and elevate the believers up to eternal life into heaven. It's one thing to hear that from Jerry Falwell and Jimmy Swaggart. It's quite something else when the President of the United States, the guy with his finger on the button, tells us, or is indicating that he embraces the same mythology, that we may be getting close to the apocalypse, the final judgment between East and West, and it's a matter of public record that he's entered into such conversations about this impending apocalypse with Jerry Falwell and other fundamentalists who themselves have talked about it, and his wonderful grasp of the Bible and how the president really knows all this stuff. Before the National Association of Evangelicals in March 1983, President Reagan proclaimed, quote, "There is sin and evil in the world, and we are enjoined by Scripture and the Lord Jesus to oppose it with all our might. The Soviet Union is an evil empire," unquote. "And the United States nuclear arm race against the Soviets is," quote, "a struggle between right and wrong, good and evil." So God, it seems, is a Cold War militarist who is preparing us for a final nuclear confrontation. A lot of this, of course, was said before the Soviets kept coming and putting everything on the table and saying, come on, let's negotiate and all that. And millions of people got out there and demonstrated and said, go to Geneva and all that sort of thing. He's been dragged kicking and screaming to Geneva. And so now he looks like he's interested, but he has managed to avoid any single arms agreement up to now. And he may very well avoid any arms agreement. Well, they say that the Russians are scared of Reagan, and I don't doubt it, because so are many Americans. It's one thing when the fundamentalist Reverend Bailey Smith, then president of the Southern Baptist Convention, tells a right-wing political rally that God, quote, "does not hear the prayer of a Jew." God is an anti-Semite, it turns out. That is, after he converted. It's something else when the president of the United States announces that the United States is, quote, "a Christian nation." Now, this surely must come as news to a loyal citizenry, which includes over 6 million Jews, several million Hindus, Muslims, and Buddhists, and millions upon millions of atheists, agnostics, skeptics, and non-sectarian deists, who together probably compose a majority of our people. It's something when Reagan gets up there at his State of the Union message and says, "This country and our Constitution could not have been formulated without divine guidance." So I sit there and I'm saying, so God is not only our father, he's our founding father. As a matter of fact, the Constitution is very clear on this. The framers at Philadelphia left the deity very much out of it. And when Benjamin Franklin suggested that their daily sessions should open with a prayer asking for divine guidance, they voted it down. And Alexander Hamilton said, we don't need foreign aid. The Constitution is very clear that ours is not a Christian nation. Article 6 reads, quote, "No religious test shall ever be required as a qualification to any office or public trust under the United States." And by the way, that was a distinct and democratic advance for one who has a very critical view of the Constitution, who feels it wasn't a very democratically motivated Constitution. Let's say that was a democratic victory for the people. It was even ahead of many state constitutions, which in those days banned Jews, Catholics, and non-believers from holding public office. And of course, the most democratic victory came not with the founding fathers, but with the concession they had to make, they were forced to make because of those democratic forces, and that was the Bill of Rights. When Colonel Mason of Virginia got up and said, let's have a Bill of Rights, that was voted down almost unanimously. I think Massachusetts abstained. Later on, they realized their tactical error, and they realized that they wanted to get this thing ratified, and if they're going to win some kind of popular support for it, they better give the people something besides what they gave themselves in the Commerce Clause and all those other goodies and bills and credits and all the other stuff for themselves. They had to give the people something, and they put through a Bill of Rights with the First Amendment. Yet the Reagan Justice Department is taking a regressive road back toward theocracy. A, ruling that the government can spend taxpayer money to subsidize religious schools. B, supporting a move to amend the Constitution so as to allow teacher-led prayer sessions in public schools. And C, pressuring the religionist crusade against safe and legal abortions. Now, here again, we're witnessing not only the religionist's use of politics, but the politician's use of religion. Take that last issue of abortion. These guys don't care one way or another about abortion. As a matter of fact, they had the opposite position. A matter of fact, conservatives for years supported legal abortion because their view was that the poor had too many babies and was too many kids on welfare, so let's have abortions, get rid of those kids. That was their position for years. Ronald Reagan, when he was governor of California, he signed the most liberal abortion bill in the world.
And his daughter had an abortion, didn't bother him at all. George Bush supported legal abortions. They've all changed now. They've all come over. And why they came over? Because they found political gold in that area. Because Richard Viguerie got up and said, hey, this is how we can split the Democratic Catholic vote. Hey, this is how we can win more of the Protestant fundamentalist vote. And Viguerie even said it. When Reagan appointed Sandra O'Connor, he said, is she soft on abortion? We cannot give up this issue. This issue helps us split the Democrats. I mean, it is the crassest case of political opportunism. Once more, as in Luther's day, using religion as an instrument of maintaining your power, religion as an instrument of class control. And Reaganism has brought forth not only the politically more conservative religious spokesmen, but also the theologically more reactionary ones. Those who evade all real social issues. You can watch these guys on television all day. You'd never know there was something called pollution or acid rain or poverty or exploitation or unemployment or inflation or unfair tax laws, ruinous tax laws. You'd never get a sense of that. You never get a sense that people are desperate, fighting, trying to stay ahead of themselves, wondering how they're going to get through their old age. You never get any of that. All you know is that you're to blame, you're weak, and all you got to do is open up your heart to Jesus and it'll all be saved. It'll all be worked out. They have no attention to poverty, oppression, to militarism. What they do is focus on personal pieties, sectarian intolerance, and a kind of prudish, repressive moralism. In the face of all the things we have to struggle with today, they're targeting Playboy magazine. Their message is the same as it's been for centuries, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters. Don't organize and struggle for social justice and against the powers that be, against the powers that exploit you, against the powers that take the money out of your paycheck before you can even get it home. Don't fight against them. Just trust in God and God's love, and above all, keep those contributions coming in. And what a God it is they sell. We already know from reading the Bible that the Judeo-Christian God is vainglorious, sadistic, murderously partisan, vindictive. In fact, if you had a person like that, you wouldn't want to associate with him for 5 minutes, let alone worship him. You might recall that God destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, including all the unoffending and innocent children and infants in those cities, because he didn't like the lifestyle of certain of the citizens and what they were doing. He took great satisfaction when his Israelites acted like imperialists and massacred. Did you read the Book of Kings where he says, and the Israelites slew 20,000? The first time I read that, I was astonished. I said, my God, and God was pleased. And the Israelites went out and they slew 35,000 and killed them all. And God was happy. I said, my God, what a God, not my God. And today it hasn't changed all that much to some degree, this whimsical, murderous God. When Mother Teresa, just last year, when Mother Teresa's plane skid on the runway, killing five of her admirers who were waiting there to receive it and maiming a whole bunch of others, she got off and she said, this was the will of God. And I'm saying to myself, but this God is Caligula. This God is one of the... or some other homicidal, mad despot. We also know that God is a terrorist and an extortionist. Listen to Oral Roberts, who says that God's going to zap me unless they come up with 8 million smackers by the end of March. By the way, Oral Roberts made that same plea last year. He said, unless I get it by the end of December 1986, God will take me. And he denied saying it until they produced the tape, the videotape with him saying it. He said, oh, did I say that? Well, I say so many things. The truth is, he says he frantically needs that $8 million for missionary scholarships. That's a lie, ladies and gentlemen. His financial empire is in serious fiduciary trouble. It's been in trouble for a number of years. And he is going to go under, and that's what he needs that money for. It's not God that's after him, it's the bankers. And what transpires in these money-grabbing forays is something right out of the Dark Age. In one TV interview I saw, Roberts was sitting there being interviewed. He and his wife were there, and he was explaining his whole appeal to this other guy who was talking to him. This is about 3 months ago. I saw this on TV, and he said, well, about $3 million come in, and then when the money stopped coming in, Satan appeared. And I'm sitting there saying, what does he mean, Satan appeared? You thought that's bad. Then his wife chimes in. She says, that's right. Satan appeared, and I said, Satan, you get on away here, and you leave my husband alone. You get out of here. And Satan, he just ran off like that. And I said, where am I? And the credulous audience actually applauded. And I said, what is this? Where am I? Is this candid camera? What is this? Am I a little Johnny Lollipop in Disneyland? Are they talking? I mean, the image of this plucky little woman standing there with, perhaps with her rolling pin and chasing off the Prince of Darkness. I mean, it just... this is something, I said, is this the 12th century? Then I thought, they couldn't get away with this in the 12th century. If some priest got up and started talking like that, probably the curia would call him up and say, what's this you're selling? Because they have a monopoly on those kind of contacts. On another occasion, I saw Jimmy Swaggart on TV, fulminating, and going and twitching his frenetic bulk across the stage, back and forth. And he paused at one moment, and he says, hold on, as if a celestial long-distance phone call suddenly came and said, God is calling me, and God is telling me something. And then he stopped, and then he told them what it was. I forget, I didn't write it down. But then I'm sitting there saying, I can't believe it. This guy actually now claims that he got this message, and they're sitting there believing this, I'd like to do, can I do an experiment here, please? Would you all just put your hands up like this? Just put your hands up there. Close your eyes, wave them a little bit. Do you feel it coming down in your hands? Well, I'm working a much harder room than Jimmy Swaggart did, But it doesn't work. I don't have it down yet. All right. Then there's, of course, Pat Robinson, who turned a Republican presidential nominee, who turned a hurricane away from his home state with God's direct intervention. And God, if he's anything, is a meteorologist. There's the Baptist minister, Everett Sullivan. Now, this guy ran in the Republican primary for governor in Nebraska. Four candidates, he came in fourth. And a woman won. And worse, to make matters worse, the Democratic nomination, a woman run. So here was the Republican gubernatorial race, two women running against each other. So what did Sullivan says? He says, this was a curse, evidence of God's curse. Quotes from the Bible, the good book, right? The good book. Jeremiah plainly tells us that when, I'm quoting Sullivan, Jeremiah plainly tells us that when the people of a nation are willing to accept the leadership of a woman, it is a sure sign of God's curse. Unquote. Talk about a sore loser, huh? Well, we always knew God was a male supremacist, too. Now, the point I want to make here is less a theological one than a political one. It's that the crude religionism of the right, it demonstrates not only the obviously anthropomorphic origin of the God image, but also the exploitative, opportunistic use of religion as an instrument of oppression, as an instrument of material acquisition, as an instrument of political power and political privilege. It is not merely that the God hucksters are silly and superstitious, rather they are keenly self-interested, manipulative, and politically powerful. Not only do the religionists preach pie in the sky by and by, but they live high off the hog here and now. While preaching otherworldliness to their followers, they're up to their ears in the crassest pursuits of wealth, power, class interests, and if we can believe what's happening to Jimmy Baker, other crass pursuits. They talk about doing good for others, but they do well for themselves. However, as I say, although history moves, and I'll sort of wrap it up here, although history moves in fitful and often uncertain steps, the general thrust has really been forward. Important democratic victories have been won. Theocratic forces still menace us. They enjoy unexpected resurgence, but they no longer rule over the Western world the way they once did. Even the Mullah theocracy in Iran is not as successful as it thought it would be in exporting the Ayatollah's fanaticism throughout the Middle East. And even the Reaganite politico-religionist revivalism is not really doing all that well, neither in Congress, nor in the courts, nor in elections and primaries, nor in the public opinion surveys. Jesse Helms had to quit that big filibuster he was doing for school prayer and all that because he wasn't getting anywhere. Because the response, even from his own state, where people are hurting for real, they're losing their farms, and this guy's sitting up there talking this hocus pocus. He had to retreat on that issue. Also today, in about a third of the world, in existing socialist countries, in communist countries, the oppressive, horrible, totalitarian Congress countries, theocracy has been thoroughly vanquished, which is not to say that religion is prohibited. Every traveler who's gone there, including Billy Graham, says that people are free to practice their religions. I was in Moscow. I was on a tour of political scientists and economists. Fort Greer, another fellow political scientist, sociologist, was on that tour. He can testify. We went into a church, and there were all these people, Russian Orthodox Church. They were praying and going on. Priest was... And I said, well, if this state is repressing this religion, it's doing a sloppy job of it, I must say. And there's freedom for synagogues, churches, Baptists, Jews, Church of Christ, Roman Catholic denominations. The misrepresentation in the West on this issue, and it's constant that religion isn't free in the USSR or other communist countries. And I think it's, again, another political use of the religious issue, because for the religionist, communism is a threat. Not only because atheism is not tolerated, but because atheism has an official status as a creed. And this is what the religionists cannot forgive. The Soviet Constitution reads that atheists have the free right to the open and free propagation of their creed. The freedom for atheist creed. And by the way, in socialist countries, about the only ones I know which explicitly give that constitutional protection to atheists. So it's kind of ironic, you know. In evil totalitarian Russia, atheism has achieved a pluralistic safeguard superior to what is found in our own supposedly democratic pluralistic society. And there's more open, unharassed freedom of belief in communist countries for religious believers than there is for atheists in the USA. We can also witness a new revolutionary development within the ranks of religion itself, especially in Latin America, with liberation theology. And the threat of liberation theology is that it doesn't diminish man to God, but puts him as the center of God's concern, and it also speaks for the interests of a different social class from the one that religionists usually represent. Liberation theology is not for theocracy, but against it. It's not for what the French call le prêtre du double menton, the priest of the double chin. It's for the hungry and the immiserated. To the extent that liberation theology has this democratic social content, it represents an historically progressive development, even if we can still disagree with them theologically about things. Instead of conjuring up a God who is the object of pietistic idolatry and interior imaginings, liberation theology sees God as manifest in social justice, in economic betterment for all the people, a more decent life here on earth, so that the lowliest among us shall be among the best, and the parasitic, the exploitative, the oppressors, the plutocrats, the dictators shall be cast aside. That's really a subversive religion. That's really getting close to what Christianity really pretended it's supposed to be about. And also in the USA, there's a Christian left that's developed, it's emerged, which sides with the poor, with the political refugees from fascism and the peace movement, and which does not support the kind of Reagan restrictions, the kind of breaking down of church and state walls, and the kind of restrictions on other people's creeds. So for some believers, at least, it seems that God is not a jingoist or a militarist or a financier, but he's a pacifist and a progressive and maybe even a revolutionary. So it becomes clear that God is about as good as the people who believe in him, which is understandably so, since he is made in their image. My own view on God is the one that's offered by the great American theologian Woody Allen, who once said that maybe God does exist, but he's an underachiever. Imagine being omnipotent and producing this, right? Tornadoes, plagues, fascists, all these things. Well, what is to be done? 3 short points, then I'll sign off, and I'm sure others will have other things to suggest here. The immediate goals that we might consider worth struggling for. First, we have to get the religionists off welfare. Make the rich churches and the multimillionaire TV evangelists pay a fair share of taxes on their immense holdings and investments. We have to get their hands, their loving, beseeching hands. We have to get those hands out of our pockets. We've got to have them stop this theocratic rule where the state forces us to subsidize them in their propagandizing of their faith, which is a violation of our beliefs and a violation of the Constitution that is using the state in that way. Not propagating their faith, they can do that. Second, free thinkers, liberation theologists, atheists, agnostics, etc. should have equal time on television. I just wrote a book called Inventing Reality, which deals with the way that political ideas and information are controlled by the news media, but the same thing could be said about creed. Alternative views are systematically shut out. Dissident opinions get no hearing. I mean, occasionally a local radio show. Madeline Murray O'Hare will be interviewed or someone else like that. But for the most part, you could just see that it's not a non-secular TV. Dissident opinions get no hearing. There's no free market of ideas. Third, we must roll back Reaganism and its war against the First Amendment and its war against the separation of church and state and against our freedom and our beliefs. And that we can... And I think the Reaganites have been weakened by the Iran-Contra scandal, and so there are new opportunities for us to fight back. Not just to complain, but to fight back, and not to feel that they're all so powerful and they're so dangerous. Not, they're dangerous, it's true, but you have to do what the great Italian communist Antonio Gramsci once said, and what Madeleine Murray O'Hare practiced, even though I bet she didn't read Gramsci on this point. He said, you must have a pessimism of the mind, be able to see the worst, the dangers, and an optimism of the will to fight back and know that there are victories that we could win and more of them will be ours. This is what we want. Even though some of us may not realize it, we are part of very much of a long historical struggle. We are involved in making history. A little, just a little bit of it, maybe a paragraph was made right out there today. To those who would make the world safe for hypocrisy, we say that our country needs something more than freedom of religion. We need freedom of belief, including the freedom not to believe in spirits and demons without putting our jobs and civil liberties at risk. Our historic task is not to vanquish religion, but to vanquish theocracy, I think, and with it, all the abuses and privileges upon which it feeds. This, ladies and gentlemen, would be, and it will be, a great victory for humanity and for democracy. Thank you.
That was Dr. Michael Parenti speaking in 1987 on the political uses of religion.
The administration is moving troops to the Adriatic. We'll have more details later in our broadcast, but a more important local story is breaking right now on the shopping beat. Let's have a consumer report from Penny Greenback in Union Square.
We're here in Union Square with the Consumer Report, where the shopping picture looks very good for retailers. Shoppers are jammed elbow to elbow on the sidewalks, and our camera crew can hardly breathe. You'd better take it in the studio. We've got to get out of here or somebody's going to get hurt.
Yeah, looks pretty serious out there, Penny. Can you tell us the mood of the shoppers? Penny? Well, it seems we've lost contact with our correspondent in Union Square. Let's move over to Van Ness and Gough, where Buck Moneylover has a story breaking live. Buck?
It's an amazing shopping miracle taking place out here, Joe. Pull the camera in for a tight shot. And here, yes, yes, there it is. A parking spot has opened up here at the corner of Van Ness and Gough, live in front of our cameras. And look out! Well, it's pretty frightening out here, Joe, but these are dedicated shoppers with only one thing on their minds.
What the hell do you think you're doing?
Oh, this battle between an Accord and a Volvo is pretty ugly, and it doesn't look like it's going to resolve itself anytime soon. Back to you, Joe.
What an incredible sight, Buck. Thanks for that remarkable coverage, and please be careful. We have some news of the American troop movements in Europe later in our broadcast. But first, an important shopping update from Duncan Cover, testing no-regrets retail waters at Kmart in Emeryville. Duncan?
It's incredible, Joe. The lines at the cash register disappear beyond the horizon. People are actually camped out, waiting for the next shipment of Chia Pets. This young woman reflects the mood of the crowd. Miss, what brings you here to Kmart today?
Must spend money! Must spend money!
I tell you, it's chaos, Joe. The computer games, the pantyhose, the Disney videos, they're flying off the shelves, and the crowds just keep demanding more and more. We've got to get out of here.
Thank you, Duncan. Duncan? Well, we're having some kind of technical difficulty over at Kmart, but we ought to bring you an update on the American troop movements in Syria. And we'll do that just as soon as we check in with our consumer expert, Willa Chargealot, at the food court near the corner of Franklin and Pine. Willa?
Table space is pretty scarce here at the food court, Joe, where shoppers are paying dearly for... Something's happening here, Joe! A madman armed with automatic rifles is spraying the crowd with bullets! And these shoppers are still determined to hold their places in line. I've never seen anything like this. It's madness. People are stepping over the bodies, charge card in hand, and maintaining consumer readiness despite the danger and the gunfire. They're still shopping as though their lives depended on it. We've got to get out of here, Joe.
Well, Willa, can you tell us the mood of the madman, Willa? Willa? Well, we've lost our reporter at Franklin and Pine. Sounds as though, despite the difficulties, we should have a great shopping season this year. We'd like to bring you an update on the troop movements in Central America, but we're out of time. Be sure to catch more late-breaking details on a retail shopping climate at 11. This is Joe Mama at National Corporate Radio.
The following commentary was written by Tim Wise and was distributed via Z Magazine's online counterpart, zmag.org. Its title is White Christmas, Holiday Cheer, Christian Iconography, and the Symbolism of Racial Supremacy. Well, it's that time of year again. Time for all good Americans to focus on what really matters. Not family, community, or world peace, but that national sacrament of late-stage capitalism known as holiday shopping. Whether you do it online or drag yourself to the mall amidst the sea of humanity scrapping and fighting for the latest must-have gizmo, rest assured that your actions are vital to the national interest. In fact, the annual consumer bonanza unleashed in the last fiscal quarter is so central to defining life in the U.S. that the economy's strength in the beginning of the following year is literally tied to how much stuff we buy. So get out there and do your duty. Buy American, be American. Shop till you drop, and remember, this is what it means to be a patriot. Now, being one who doesn't like to give advice that I myself am unwilling to follow, I must say that I too have been making the pilgrimage to the shopping centers lately, both to purchase desired items and also to observe others in the process of this sociologically fascinating ritual. As someone who regularly writes about racism, you can probably imagine that I have long been especially intrigued by the way in which holiday symbolism replicates notions of whiteness as rightness and acts to reinforce, however subtly, racial supremacism. Yet, the full force of this process never really hit me until last week. It was then that I found myself at the mall, passing a line of parents and their children, waiting to have a few seconds alone with Santa. You know, Santa, right? The big white guy who only works one day a year, yet no one calls him lazy? The big white guy who exploits elf labor in a sweatshop for no pay while his wife does all the housework, and yet no one calls him a slave master? The big white guy who invades millions of homes on Christmas Eve, and yet no one arrests him for breaking and entering? Yeah, that one. Though there has been an attempt to make use of Santas of color in malls around the country lately, I think we can all agree this is pretty absurd. If Santa were black, there is little question he'd have been shot dead years ago in the vestibule of some New York City apartment by the NYPD's Street Crimes Unit. After all, how could the cop be sure that the toy gun he was bringing to the child inside wasn't real? Better safe than sorry, and anyway, that bright red suit would make him a logical target, seeing as how red is a color favored by the members of the Bloods street gang. But it wasn't this kind of irony about a black Santa that animated the comment I heard while strolling through the mall that day. No, it was pure racial resentment and nothing else, leading the white woman, child in tow, to say to her friend, "Don't you think it's silly to have these black Santas? Everybody's trying to be so PC. I mean, come on, a black Santa? Everyone knows Santa's white." Her friend, of course, agreed. Everyone knows Santa, a make-believe entity, for those who haven't figured it out yet, is white. The insistence on the racial purity of this entirely fictional being, as if this was a real person, struck me as hilarious, and right up there with the folks who send get-well cards to their favorite soap opera characters when they fall ill on the shows. Ronald and Nancy Reagan are reported to have done this once. Fantasy, reality, screw it, who cares? I'm starting to realize the awful truth. White people are certifiably insane. It all made sense, though, once I passed the woman and noticed the holiday stationery and cards in her bag. the ones with the calming, soothing face of Jesus staring back at me. You know the Jesus I'm talking about, right? The one with the pale skin, blue eyes, and rock star good looks. Yeah, that one. The same Jesus that has occupied the minds of Western Christians for the last 5 centuries, ever since Michelangelo was commissioned to paint his image and used his lily-white cousin as a sitting model. Oh, shit, I've stepped in it now. Questioning the ethnic heritage of Christ himself, and you thought this was just going to be a cute little diatribe about the commercialization of the Yuletide season. Au contraire, mon frère. My wife and I have received many a Christmas card this season, and, as always, the representations of Jesus that adorn so many of them cast the Christian Messiah as nothing if not European. Now, I know my Gentile friends have that song, A Child is Born in Bethlehem, but I never realized until now that they meant Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. Silly me, but I had always thought the Christ child was born in that part of the world we call the Middle East, which, if we were being honest, we would easily recognize as basically a part of Africa, separated from the continent by the man-made Suez Canal. As such, the odds of him looking the way he does in churches across America are pretty much slim and none. But don't tell that to most of his followers, especially the ones who are white, like me. The suggestion that Jesus would have been dark-skinned, black in the admittedly non-scientific racial taxonomy of the United States, is about as blasphemous to most Christians as anything one could say. Of course, no one wants to admit their indignation at the notion, so they typically couch it in ecumenical platitudes like, "It doesn't matter what Jesus looked like, it only matters what he did." Okay, fine, I'm down with that. Although not a Christian, I've always been the one who thought Jesus said and did some pretty exemplary stuff, unlike what so many of his modern disciples say and do. So then, if it doesn't matter what he looked like, then why not make him black? I have asked this question when giving speeches on racism at religiously affiliated colleges, and let's just say there's nothing like it if you're looking to see how fast you can get folks to start clearing their throats. Again, they insist, "No, you don't understand. It doesn't matter what he looked like, it's what he did." And again, I repeat, "Okay, fine. If it really doesn't matter, then let's make him black, just for a year. Then you can change him back if you really want to. No biggie." No dice and no takers. We go round and round as white folks check their watches and try to figure out how they can leave the room without seeming to be rude. But let's be clear. The white iconography of Jesus that predominates in this culture makes absolutely no sense, except as an artifact of a white supremacist worldview. First off, the earliest representations of Jesus, Mary, and Christ's disciples appear in the catacombs of Rome, where the first Christians known as Essenes buried their dead. All of these portrayals picture a dark-skinned Messiah. In addition, during the time of the Roman Emperor Justinian II, the empire minted a gold coin that pictured Jesus. This coin, which today can be viewed in the British Museum, shows a man with clearly non-white facial features and tightly curled hair, consistent with the description of Christ offered in the Book of Revelations, wherein it is noted that Jesus had hair like wool, feet the color of burnt brass, and resembled jasper and sardine stones, both of which were brown in color. Now, I don't much care about the scriptural references myself, and far be it for me to insist on the infallibility of the Bible. But if the folks who do swear that every word of it has to be accepted as literal don't also accept these descriptions, which clearly contradict the imagery on the Christmas cards, or that of the nativity scenes one sees everywhere at this time of year, then they are nothing, if not hypocrites. And don't forget, according to biblical lore, when Jesus was born, Herod sent search parties out to find him and slay him as an infant. To hide the Christ child, his family absconded with him to Egypt. And if there is one thing we can be absolutely sure of, it's that no one would have been likely to try hiding an Aryan baby and family in pre-Arab Egypt, of all places. This was, after all, a society of dark-skinned Africans, as evidenced in their own hieroglyphs. One that had referred to itself as Kemet, the Black Land, for thousands of years, and themselves as Kemetku, the Black Humans. The father of modern history, Herodotus, himself acknowledged as much when he said, quote, "The Egyptians, Colchians, and Ethiopians have thick lips, broad nose, woolly hair, and are of burnt skin." Elsewhere, he actually referred to them as black. If Jesus had been white, Mary and Joseph would have put him on a slow boat to Canada, not trekked to Egypt, where finding them would have been like shooting fish in the proverbial barrel. For those of you still reading or listening, you'll be either laughing or fuming. If laughing, it's because you realize how silly the whitening of Jesus has been in this culture, and yet how wedded we are to that imagery. If fuming, well, it's because you think that somehow I'm being sacrilegious or absurd. But I'm just reading what the good book says and applying a little common sense and anthropology to the process. If you really want to see absurd, go pick up Volume 1 of the Robert Maxwell Bible Stories series, which I assure you is sitting on a table in your doctor's office right now. There you'll find Adam and Eve depicted as if the Garden of Eden had been in Norway, despite the fact that biblical scholars all agree the garden, whether viewed as a literal place or as a fictional metaphor, was bordered by two rivers, the biblical description of which only fits that of the Blue Nile and the White Nile, neither of which, last time I checked, were to be found in Scandinavia. Some may ask, what's the point of all this, though frankly it ought to be obvious? So long as our culture pictures Adam, Eve, Moses, Jesus, Mary, the apostles, and even God himself as fair-skinned folk, despite the obvious preposterousness of such representations, we will continue to plant the seeds of racial supremacism in the hearts and minds of millions of people. After all, to believe that divinity is white like you leads one to easily assume that others are somehow less complete, less human. If God supposedly made man in his image, and God is always portrayed as a bearded white man, kinda like Santa without the suit, how hard a leap is it, especially for children, whose introduction to religion is always nine-tenths forced propaganda anyway, to assume that persons of color are somehow not full and equal children of God? Not to mention the sexist aspect of the male sky god imagery, of course, which is a whole different can of worms. So now that I have managed to piss everyone off, here's wishing you all a very Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah, Joyous Kwanzaa, Resplendent Ramadan, and Super Solstice. Now get out there and shop. And take that damned Swedish-looking angel off the top of your tree, for God's sake. Tim Wise is a Nashville-based writer, lecturer, and activist. He can be reached at tjwise@mindspring.com. And I was reading from his essay, White Christmas, Holiday Cheer, Christian Iconography, and the Symbolism of Racial Supremacy. In this darkness and midnight, when the pot-bellied feast chase their unwelcome guests. Special thanks to the Jolly Roger Comedy Troupe of San Francisco Liberation Radio, GWBush.com, and to Vancouver Indie Media for their contributions to this program. Unwelcome guests will take a break next week. Thanks for listening, happy holidays, and see you in the new year.
If you have an event you'd like us to announce or an issue you'd like us to cover on the program, you can contact us at our website at www.radioforall.org/unwelcome. That's radio, the number 4, ALL.org/unwelcome. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guests is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lind, Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content.
Catch me napping one day and they'll kill me. Then I'll be gone, but that won't be my end. For my guns and my saddle.